Good morning. Still morning. We're going to call this meeting of TRPA Governing Board to order. The date is Wednesday, September 22, 2021. It's approximately 11:21. First item on the agenda is a roll call to determine a quorum. And Catherine or Maria, will you please call the roll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Alding? Mr. Bruce?
Here.
Mrs. Sagaski?
I know she's here.
And also I'm here. Mark Vlashin is her proxy as well. But she is on the line. I'll confirm as well.
Thank you.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much.
Ms. Faustinos?
She's here too,
I know. We can see you. We can see you. Thank you. Mr. Friedrich?
Here.
Ms. Gustafson?
Here.
Mr. Hicks?
Here.
Ms. Hill?
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
Ms. Novosel? Mr. Rice?
Here.
Ms. Williamson?
Here.
Mr. Yates?
Here.
And Ms. Novosel?
She was here this morning. I think she's here. Oh, she shows as being here. She's just muted. I also...
We do have a quorum, Mr.
Excellent. We have a quorum. I'll also report that Shelley emailed me this morning. She's at a memorial. She'll be jumping on as soon as she can. Okay? All right. Thank you. So now I'd like to go over the meeting rules for the day. To observe and participate in the meeting, go to www.trpa.gov, select September 22nd, 2021, Governing Board Meeting on the calendar, and follow the link to the webinar. Members of the public can find all meeting materials there as well. To participate in this Governing Board meeting with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the GoToWebinar platform with the appropriate agenda item. If you wish to make a comment about something not on the agenda, we will hear your comments during the general public comment period at the end of the meeting, agenda item 13. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the Governing Board. If you have contacted TRPA for a reasonable accommodation, received a unique PIN for dial-in, please make sure you enter the PIN so that you may be identified and unmuted by TRPA staff. If you are using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it is open in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. If you are joining via the call-in number posted on our website, please note that this is a listen-only option. If you wish to address the Governing Board, you will need to log in via GoToWebinar on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, or dial your unique PIN number. To remote Governing Board members, if you wish to speak, please alert me via the chat function. If you are online, or speak up if you are calling in, please set your chat box now to message panelists and organizers to ensure that I see your message. Remote board members may only use the chat function to indicate a desire to speak. This function must not be used to have sidebar conversations. Please remember to mute your mic unless speaking to cut down on background noise. Finally, I would like to have all the remote members turn on their cameras, as we now have sufficient capacity on our platform to accommodate everyone. At this point in time, we'll move to item number 2, Pledge of Allegiance. And I would ask that Catherine please lead us in the pledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Catherine. Appreciate that.
Okay. Give me one moment here. We'll move to item number three. That's the approval of the agenda. Let's see, Julie, are there any changes to the agenda?
No changes, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. We'll deem the agenda approved as posted. We'll move to item number four, approval of minutes. As it stated in our packets on page 8, minutes from the August 25, 2021 governing board meeting will be provided in the October packet. So we'll be moving to approve those next month. Moving to item number 5, TRPA consent calendar. See, there's one item on consent that was not reviewed by any committee. As a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. The item on consent is a resolution for the Quagga Zebra Mussel Infestation Prevention Grant Program application and funding agreement in the amount of $398,433.98. This is a routine approval for this grant application. Information on this item can be found on page 9 of your packets. We will now go to public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff, and I'll turn it over at this point in time to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, may I get a motion to approve the consent calendar?
Please. Mr. Chairman, I move the consent calendar.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. I would now like to move to item 6, planning matters. Item 6A, update discussion on the Caldor fire. The information on this item can be found on page 11. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. And at this point in time, I would like to pass it over to Julie Reagan so she can set this item up. I really do appreciate the staff's time and consideration in putting this item together. Really appreciate the guest presenters that we have to take us through one of the most difficult times that we've had at Tahoe. Julie, please take this item from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Governing Board and members of the public and staff. I'm Julie Reagan. I'm the Chief of External Affairs and Deputy Director at TRPA. Today, I'm your Acting Executive Director. Joanne Marchetta successfully had her hearing surgery last week. She's recovering well and sends you all her best. So I will be taking the mantle for her for the next couple of board meetings, and totally appreciate all your support as we work through that issue on top of the Caldor fire. And as the chairman said, this has been a really difficult time for our entire community. And I just wanted to kick this presentation off before we move into our special guest speakers, which we're most pleased that we're able to free up their time today to join us. So I'd like to talk about the fire first by expressing our immeasurable gratitude for the thousands of firefighters and personnel who raced toward one of the largest fires in California's history to protect lives, homes, businesses, and wildlife, and of course, our precious environment. As thousands fled to safety and many more prepared for the worst, those brave women and men worked tirelessly to control the uncontrollable. Much has been lost in the Caldor fire, but much more has been saved because of the fire service. And we join the community and our many partner agencies in thanking them and applauding their incredible work. Let's first not forget that the fire is not over. It is still being fought in some areas, and heavy smoke is still impacting Tahoe and the Eastern Sierra. Tragically, more than 1,000 homes and structures were lost just outside the Tahoe Basin, and our hearts go out to our affected neighbors in El Dorado County. I want to take this opportunity to share what our local community and our TRPA staff have gone through over the last month, many of you included. I'm going to ask for your indulgence as I walk you through a few points before we move into our presentations. The Calder Fire sparked on August 14th, which seems now like an eternity ago. As the fire approached and evacuation warnings turned to orders, TRPA staff held tightly to our core values of community support and customer service. In just a few days, our computer servers and other equipment were relocated from our building to safety and brought back online. This IT challenge was enormous. The work that we do here at the agency supports so many functions of our society, including the real estate community, one of Tahoe's major industries, with $25 billion, yes, billion dollars, in assessed real estate values at Tahoe. Our data that we safeguard and our workflow systems are crucial to the local economy, not to mention the numerous resource protection plans that we have in our computer systems, among other important functions of the agency. TRPA didn't miss a beat, and there's a slide that I think we're going to try to put on the screen. We call this our evacuation scatter map. We really didn't miss a beat on the work front despite these evacuation orders, and our staff were then forced to crash at friends' homes, shelter with family, moving all across the country because of the fire, forcing us away from the Tahoe Basin. This map really just shows all points from where we dispersed, truly from coast to coast and even into Mexico, as people had to flee out of the Tahoe Basin. Nearly three quarters of our staff evacuated, joining the other 30,000 residents of the South Shore who left their homes. Truly unprecedented. The entire town had to leave. Members of our staff in the Carson Valley opened their homes to their coworkers as well, and many, many folks were seen camping in the driveways of some of our colleagues and friends in the Nevada area, in Carson City and in Reno. So at the points of all of these evacuation dots, you can see that we were far and wide. And actually, I'm still one point on the dot. I'm still in the Sonoma wine country area in the process of relocation, just still dealing with some of the smoke issues in the basin. So hopefully I'll get back full-time home very soon. So we can take the slide down. Thank you very much. It was a dramatic and a traumatic experience that I think we all are still reeling from on many levels. And many of you offered support during this difficult time. And on behalf of all staff, I just want to say thank you. But despite the challenging circumstances, we kept the agency humming right along, including continuing a scheduled hearings officer meeting through technical difficulties. We processed permit applications, working out of cars and campers, and really kept the agency workflow going. It was truly a Herculean effort. So big kudos to our team for everything they did to preserve our services and themselves and their families. Even our boat crew acted fast to move the TRPA education boats to the North Shore for safety. And for those of us in Myers and Christmas Valley, we have many staff that live in the affected areas of where the fire entered the basin. We watched the video feeds in horror as the flames surrounded our homes and our treasured landscape. Some media dubbed it a Christmas Valley miracle. Our Lake Valley fire chief said it was actually firefighting and preparation that saved our beloved Christmas Valley. And I want to put a fine point on this. Tahoe was prepared for this fire. For those of you who have been on the board for some years, you'll remember COSWO, who beat the drum of fire preparedness and hazardous fuel reduction for more than 15 years. This was going back 15 years ago, even before the Angora fire. He was right. And this agency has played a major leadership role over the last decade in securing funds for forest health projects and policy shifts to promote fire defensible space and preparedness. So let's turn to today's item on the fire. Our presentations aren't intended to distill everything that we've gone through since the fire erupted. The good news is that reports coming out of the incident are unequivocal. The fuel reduction, defensible space, and home hardening that went on in Christmas Valley and other neighborhoods made a difference here in Tahoe. And the work that made the difference started even before Angora of 2007. With your support and leadership, Basin Partners have treated nearly 70,000 acres for fuel reduction in the basin since Angora and 45,000 defensible space evaluations. That's basically every parcel and then some have been conducted by fire protection agencies, all in preparation for our next fire, which we know will come. So today, I wanted to orient you to what you'll be hearing. We have basically three blocks of presentations, a presentation by the U.S. Forest Service, we have two representatives from CAL FIRE, and then we have two of our own TRPA staffers, Kim Carringer, who will wrap out the presentation, and then we'll take your questions at the end. So if you could just make note of your questions and hold them until we get through, we would be happy to answer them at that point. So thanks for indulging that introduction. Very much appreciate it. The Angora fire was a major milestone in this agency's history, and I feel that the Calder fire will as well, not only for what we just went through, but how we pivot to looking at everything we do in the lens of climate resiliency and preparedness for more extreme events, which we know Tahoe will experience in the future. So with that, I would like to turn now the microphone over to Gwen Sanchez. Gwen is the acting supervisor in the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit of the U.S. Forest Service, and Gwen was integral in the fire incident, and we're really pleased that she can be here. She's super busy, and glad that, Gwen, you're here. I will turn the microphone to you, and thank you.
Great. Thank you, Julie, Mr. Chairman, the rest of the board. Thank you so much for having me this morning and allowing me some time with all of you. My name again is Gwen Sanchez, and I'm the acting forest supervisor for the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit. And I've been one of the agency administrators on the Caldor fire since about 30 days now. So I've been at it for some time now. So I just want to give you guys a quick update on the fire, and then I'll go into some of the different stages and maybe some of the what's to come, what's next portion of Caldor. So as of this morning, we were sitting at about 219,500 acres and 76% contained. I'm sure you all saw over the last couple of days that we did have an increase in smoke. As Julie said, we've come a long way and we've had a lot of success on this fire, but it is not over yet. There are still some areas that are very difficult to get into, and we continue to work on those areas. Two of those areas of note, one is the Desolation Wilderness. As you all know, it's very remote, very rocky. We have crews that have been spiking out, which means have been staying along that fire line day and night for about 3.5 weeks now. So we will cycle those crews out every 7 to 10 days and get them refreshed with logistical support, water, food, and put them back in. So they've been actively engaged in the Desolation Wilderness area. The second area, again, a very, very difficult area to access, is down near Caples Lake. That's where a lot of the smoke has been coming from over the last couple days. Again, the area is very rocky, and with the conditions being so dry right now, the fuels conditions, this fire just continues to look for opportunity. And as we get different wind shifts, that just pushes the fire, you know, in and around those rocks and trying to find more and more fuel opportunity. We do have lines in place. We already have a primary dozer line built on the east side of that, as well as a contingency line beyond that. But we're trying to just, you know, make sure that we've got crews in there going after all of those spots and making sure that those primary lines remain in place. So as of right now, all of the fire and the smoke that you see is within those primary and contingency lines, but we're probably going to see some of that smoke continue over the next couple days simply because those fuels are so dry. And the longer we go without any moisture or recovery, the drier those fuels are getting, and the more available to burn those fuels, you know, we see those fuels. So Haldor Fire has just been so resistant to control since really day one, and we're going to continue to see some of those resistance and control issues until we get some moisture and a significant weather event that will help us in that fight. And so we're going to have some smoke, and we're going to be having some suppression action taken on the Caldor Fire, likely for some time to come. So I just want to make sure that you folks, know that we're not over yet. We've made great progress, but there's still some fight left in this fire that we're needing to continue to stay diligent on. So when I look at the Caldor Fire and other fires, I really like to think of fire in terms of four different phases. So the first phase, which most people are the most familiar with, is the suppression phase. And that's really the active suppression of any fire. The second phase is the repair phase. So the suppression repair phase. We bring in dozers, we bring in equipment to suppress those fires, to put fire line in. And as a result, we may damage different infrastructure. We may damage culverts or different, fences, some of the ground that we need to repair. And so the second phase is repairing the damage that occurred as a result of suppression actions. The third phase is the bare phase, and that is the burned area emergency rehabilitation phase. And so that bare phase is really all about stabilization. That's how I like to think about the bare portion of an incident, that emergency stabilization. So what are those actions that need to take place in order to ensure that we don't have future emergencies as a result of the suppression actions? And so we'll go in. We actually have a team that is mobilized right now. We have folks that are from TRPA that are embedded with our team, and they're going out and analyzing the Caldor footprint, and they are looking at what are those actions that need to be prioritized to stabilize this ground, to stabilize the fire, to repair those areas in the short term so that we can start this recovery phase. The stage four and final phase is the long-term recovery phase. And so, folks, when we look at the Caldor Fire, I'm looking at that recovery phase lasting not weeks and months, but years. We could be looking at that recovery phase for the next couple of years collectively and in partnership with all of you, as well as a lot of the other partners that we regularly work with in and around the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit and Lake Tahoe Basin broadly interagency partnership. This long-term recovery phase is really about resiliency. How do we help the Caldor Fire repair itself and be more resilient into the future? And so it really is our attempt at trying to help this fire area become more resilient and do it quicker. And so streamline that recovery process for this footprint. And so again, right now we are engaged in that bare assessment. So the emergency response and stabilization assessment, we will have a report, and we actually have an InsaWeb site that you can go on. You can see the soil severity mapping of the entire fire. You can start seeing the products that have come out of that assessment. And those are public products that all of you have access to. And so I'd encourage you to look at that area. And we've got a team of specialists doing this from really all over the country. And as I said before, it's not just U.S. Forest Service specialists. We have other specialists that have interest specifically within the basin that are a part of that team and a part of that process. And so we should have that final report back from that team in another couple of weeks. And then once we have that report, that'll allow us to build that program of work over that long-term recovery phase. So let's talk a little bit about this long-term recovery phase and how we need to all come together, and what U.S. Forest Service is asking our partners to come together in helping us accomplish. So I already spoke to the assessment phase, which we've got a lot of our partners that are well engaged in that already. And as part of that assessment process, then we've got the project development phase. And so once we know what areas of concern we have on this fire and what areas we need to prioritize, then we'll develop that project list. What is it that we actually have to get accomplished on the ground? We got another tier of this that I am looking to our partners to help us with, and that's the communication piece. It's going to be really, really important that we continue to communicate with our publics and in coordination with each other, making sure we're using the same words and making sure that our communication is in alignment and very clear to understand. This is a tough one because, you know, I think a lot of people expect that as the smoke leaves, that the fire is done. And really, that's the beginning of the work that we are all going to have to come together to accomplish. And so how do we rally with each other to really clearly identify that communication piece to the publics that we're serving? And we'll be working with our partners in order to accomplish a lot of that communication. And then the last piece is the funding, right? How do we all come together to pay for those priority projects to make sure that this long-term recovery and repair is completed and it's to our collective standards, making sure that we're doing the best that we can to get the Caldor Fire in a good path forward towards not only recovery, but resiliency into the future. And so that'll be really important as we come together. The one thing that I did want to just quickly comment on before I kick it off to Chief Anthony is the collective work that we have done. And Julie had spoke to it just briefly, but since 2008, I got a couple numbers for you. Since 2008, within the Lake Tahoe Basin, we've treated 65,000 acres, and that's collectively with the entire Tahoe Fire and Fuels team, which is significant. That's a great accomplishment. And all of our partnerships should be so proud of that and the work that we've done collectively together. Of that, about 50,000 acres of that has been on the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit. You all know that we have a large footprint within this basin. So we've been working really hard with those partnerships to make sure that we're doing our part in protecting these communities and building more resilient landscapes if and when the fires do come into the Lake Tahoe Basin. This is a perfect example of that. There was every reason for all of these bad things to align and have bad outcome. And folks, because of the effort that we did, we had a great outcome. And when you go out onto the ground and you see the areas that we treated in comparison to the areas that we were not able to treat, it's night and day difference. And it's really impressive on the ground. Within the Caldor Fire footprint, 3,800 acres of that in the Lake Tahoe Basin had been treated. And those treatments adjusted, changed that fire intensity, reduced the fire flame fronts and the flame lengths, and really provided our firefighters a safe way to get in and allowed them the opportunities to get in safely and really suppress this fire. We could have had a much, much different, much worse outcome, and we didn't. And it's because of the partnerships and the work that we collectively did in protecting these communities and infrastructure. I know that the rest of the folks next will talk a little bit more about those treatments and how it adjusted and gave our firefighters such opportunity and a safe engagement opportunity. And so with that, I will pass it on to Chief Anthony. Thank you all again for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Gwen. So good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the chair and the board for the opportunity to be here today. It's been quite a while since I've had an opportunity to address the board. So what I'm going to do is between myself and Assistant Chief Brian Newman, we're going to break this up into two parts. And Brian's going to address some operational issues associated with the fire. I'll let him introduce himself and his role on the incident. And then I'll take it from there. So Chief Newman.
All right. Good morning. Thanks for letting me come on and speak about my role and really kind of what we did for part of the fire. So first off, my name is Brian Newman. I'm the Assistant Chief for CAL FIRE in the Amador El Dorado Unit, our East Division Operations, which is the Lake Tahoe Basin and Alpine County area. And so my role on the fire was as one of our operations section chiefs. And what that consists of is really the one of the people that directs the firefight on the ground, directs the resources, develops the plan, and implements the plan. So myself and Kyle Jacobson, who is the chief two with the Forest Service here in the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, was one of the other operations chiefs. We worked side by side, hand in hand, in coordinating that effort as the fire progressed into the basin. So I'll pick up the timeline on the Sunday prior to the fire getting into the basin. Obviously, it had burned quite a bit of acreage and quite a bit of destruction on the west slope prior to that. But as we engaged it here in the Tahoe area on Sunday, the fire hadn't quite crested the crest there on Echo Summit. So we were up there making plans and attempting firefighting up there with all of our resources, engines and hand crews and bulldozers, trying to make an effective stop on the fire at the crest there. And we were fairly effective for withholding the fire from the basin that evening and overnight. But then as we got into Monday, we did have an increase in winds and increase in some fire activity, which led to the fire spotting into the basin, first and foremost along Highway 50 in the Frog Pond area and starting into some of the Christmas Valley area. And we started picking up some activity, and it basically caused us to have to fall back to utilizing the highway and instituting our secondary plan. So starting Sunday evening and Monday before the fire had come into there, we had, myself and Chief Jacobson had started with a plan for contingency planning, and that was with putting bulldozers down in the Christmas Valley, down in the North Upper Truckee area to develop and build fire lines behind all the homes and really plan for an alternative plan if need be, if the fire did get into the basin. So those plans were concurrent with the firefighting that was going on top of the Echo Summit area. And so as we Monday had the fire spot into the basin, we were able to utilize those fire lines that we had developed and continue to push those dozers around the backs of the homes on the east side of Christmas Valley and then further north in North Upper Truckee and onto the Angora Ridge area to really create a good defensible fire line that we could utilize to slow the fire spread as it moved to the east there, coming down into the basin. So as the fire did end up spotting over the Christmas Valley and into the area directly to the east of Christmas Valley on the slopes there by the Luther Spire and into the Cowboy Hat Rock area, we started to have that increase in activity and the fire pushing off to the north and east. And then we utilized our resources to continue to affect point protection and to allow for construction of fire line along and behind the homes in the Apache area, Pioneer Trail, the old dump site, and moving towards Cold Creek. And one of the things that really helped us as we were dealing with the firefight in all of those areas was, a couple things. We were able to utilize the fuel reduction that had been done in and around those areas in the Oneidas and in towards the High Meadow area, both with Chief Jenkinson and myself being part of the local contingent here. We were aware of where those areas for opportunities were, where we're able to have favorable areas with trails and road systems, the fuel reduction. And so we were able to direct the firefighters in there to be able to make an effective stand along that perimeter of the fire before it was able to impact the homes. Along with that, the Tahoe Fuels and Fire team did provide a good map layer for us that we were able to utilize for where all the fuel reductions had been done in various places, and recognized that that was also a good opportunity to have effective direct attack. And direct attack is really where we can get right on that fire edge and put that fire line in and put the hose lines in to be able to extinguish a fire on that perimeter and really slow and stop its spread. So it was a really coordinated effort with a lot of collaboration with all the agencies, being able to put it all together and really direct the fire activity and the fire attack as it moved off onto the Heavenly area, Trimmer Peak, and that area. So we did have some established decision points, so one of those being the Cold Creek area for recommending any additional evacuations. The fire did approach that specific area, but we were able to make an effective stop before it hit that Cold Creek area specifically. And so overall, I think the defensible space of the homes also allowed for us to be able to get in and do that direct attack nearest the homes in that Apache, Mandan, and areas there off of Pioneer Trail. That was a huge help for us as well. And that's, again, part of the local knowledge that we were able to institute as part of the firefight. So overall, I feel it was very successful. It was a really challenging incident, but overall, between all the agencies, federal, state, and local, we're able to really coordinate and do a good, effective firefight to get us to the point where we are for now.
Thank you very much. Chris?
Yeah, thank you so much. I guess I'll segue from there, and that is, we would have never scenarioed out a situation where a fire would have started down south of Grizzly Flat and ended up in South Lake Tahoe. And the reason I point that out is things are dramatically changing as it relates to the way wildfire burns through landscapes. I think we've seen that play out year over year, and this year really is no different with the Dixie Fire to our north, which is really one of the largest single ignition fires that we've ever seen. Just south of that, it was Beckworth that you may recall earlier in the summer, Caldor in the basin, and then Tamarack in Alpine County. And those are just four fires, not to mention all the other ones that many of which were burning simultaneously throughout the state at the same time that the Caldor fire ignited and started south of Grizzly Flat. So for starters, one of the things I just want to say is thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to thank TRPA for their support throughout all the years. And I've tried to be very direct in that TRPA has been an outstanding partner to CAL FIRE and to the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team as it relates to all of the work that we've done over the years that resulted, in my opinion, in a really remarkable success in the Lake Tahoe Basin. The reason that I think that's important to mention is because there really are no guarantees when it comes to the way wildfire burns through landscapes anymore. However, what we need to do is we need to ensure that we're doing absolutely everything that we can to give firefighters that opportunity to be successful. So I just want to take a second, and Julie did a great job covering a lot of it. But one of the things that really struck me as we were progressing into Caldor, I had a lot of uncertainty in terms of what was the outcome was going to be, just based on the previous fire behavior that we had seen as it came up the American River Canyon and as it crested into the Lake Tahoe Basin. And quite honestly, we were planning for the fire to continue through the basin into Nevada, and potentially all the way down to the Mesa and the bottom of Kingsbury Grade. So when it comes to Lake Tahoe Basin specifically, what my takeaway from the Caldor incident is there has been a lot of really great work done by the Tahoe Fire Fuels team in the leveraging of all the resources that we bring to bear to be able to address this issue. And some people may say that 21 entities is really too many, In Lake Tahoe Basin, I would disagree with that. I think it's a very functional group and has been for many years. And it's actually formed under the Incident Command System, which is the same system that we use to manage major incidents like the Caldor fire. And in really, if you look at everything that has been done as it relates to home hardening, defensible space around homes, the chipping programs that have been provided through the local fire protection districts to help homeowners get rid of hazardous fuels from around their house, to the pre-attack planning that has been done in the Lake Tahoe Basin, around the entire basin with all of the fire districts, Cal Fire, the Forest Service, our law enforcement partners, much of which was actually through a grant that TRPA submitted to Cal Fire to get funding for that, to the fuels reduction projects that have been put on that Chief Newman just mentioned, as well as the larger landscape projects that are being looked at around the basin specific to like Lake Tahoe West, as well as the evacuation planning that we've done, and then all the community wildfire preparedness meetings that we've done. It really has to be this cohesive and really well coordinated approach to be able to have or achieve success the way that fires are now burning through the landscape. And as Gwen mentioned, the resistance to control of the Caldor was really remarkable. The unified teams between Cal Fire and the Forest Service were literally doing everything they possibly could to stop the approach of the Caldor fire as it came into the Lake Tahoe Basin. But again and again, it would continue to spot over those lines. And that's really just reflective of how dry things are right now throughout the state with the drought that we're in, the lack of snow melt that we saw this last winter, and obviously the increasing rising temperatures that we're seeing throughout the state year after year after year. And then lastly, many of the areas that it burned through, we had really dense forests, which also contributed to the spread of the incident also. So I don't think that you can necessarily talk about the Caldor fire without actually anchoring back into the Angora fire. And the reason I bring that up is, and I think some people on this webinar were part of this, and that was the Emergency California-Nevada Tahoe Basin Fire Commission that was formed by then Governor Jim Gibbons from Nevada and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger from California. And out of that those commission hearings, which, let me back up, I'm really thankful that we're in a much different place today than we were back in 2007. But out of those commission hearings came 90 recommendations that were very specific to the Lake Tahoe Basin. And out of those 90 recommendations back in 2017, as we were leading up to the Lake Tahoe Summit, all the agencies got together and for a couple months, we looked at each one of those recommendations to see where were we at? Had we achieved some success in meeting those recommendations? And at the end of the day, back in 2017, 59% of those 90 recommendations had been completed. Another 25% had been partially completed, 7% were ongoing, and 9% had not been completed. And I still think that there's room for improvement there as we look forward, because what we ended up doing is really leveraging all the resources that we had or that we could bring to the table to be able to address all of those recommendations. And I think every agency that was part of those commission hearings was really committed to trying to see those recommendations through. As both Brian and Gwen mentioned, the fuels reduction projects and the forest health projects that were completed made a significant difference in the way that this fire burned through the landscape. And I can just tell you a personal story. When I was out there, and I believe it was Kyle Jacobson, when I heard him talk about how the fire had transitioned out of the crowns of the trees above Oneidas onto the ground in the area where the Forest Service had completed some of their fuels reduction work, that was the first time that I realized that we probably had a chance to contain the fire and keep it from entering into the built environment in South Lake Tahoe. At that point, they were able to put resources direct onto the fire using dozers and hand crews and engine companies and really begin to make progress because they had a safe area to work. In addition to that, when you go back into those areas now, what you'll see, the treated areas fared very well. There's still live green living trees in those areas. But above that, in those untreated areas, you'll see quite a bit of stand replacement fire where it's pretty much 100% mortality up in those upper watersheds. So going back to the recommendations that came out of the commission, I still think that those are important to look at. And one of those recommendations that came out of the commission was really specific to the slope restrictions for mechanized equipment. So in the Lake Tahoe Basin, we have a 30% slope restriction on mechanized equipment. And we've been talking for years about the need to elevate that slope restriction in order to be able to do more forest resilience work more effectively. Otherwise, we would have to use hand crews, which quite honestly would take too much time and wouldn't be very efficient. The state has different standards under the California Forest Practices Act as it relates to that slope restriction. And I would really encourage the board, and I know that this is something that we've talked about for a long time. I know it's something that TRPA has been diligently working on, but I would really encourage the board to take a second look at that. And specifically, as we look at Lake Tahoe West, as well as additional fuels reduction projects that need to be done around the basin, and given the advancements in mechanized equipment and the technology that exists, I think it's really critical and will help us get to a more resilient forest more quickly. I'm always one to hit home the point that we still are at risk. And the reason I mentioned Dixie and Beckworth and Caldor and Tamarack is because we're seeing much larger fires that are much more severe, they're much more damaging, they last longer. And in addition to that, we're seeing multiple fires occurring at the same time. And the reason that's so important is because we only have so many resources in this state that we can allocate to fires. And so if we have five or six major fires all burning concurrently, there is a major resource drawdown that occurs in California. And really what we need to be shooting for is landscapes that are more resilient to fire and that can withstand the effects of fire. Because remind you, our forests were naturally adapted to fire at one point in time. And we can see that in those fire return intervals based on research that's been done around the Lake Tahoe Basin. That's where we need to get back to as it relates to forest resiliency. And thankfully, through the good work of all the partner agencies and all the preparedness and the prevention and the planning that led up to the Caldor, as well as the amazing efforts of the firefighters and the law enforcement officers on the ground, we had a success. And we don't get a lot of successes. This is a great story to share. I think there's a lot to learn here. There's still a lot of work to do in the Lake Tahoe Basin. And so I'll leave it with that and turn it back to Julie. And then I know that we'll be doing some questions later. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Julie?
Oh, thank you, Chief and Gwen. I'm now going to pivot to Kim Carringer and Kat McIntyre from TRPA staff to drill down into the support that our teams are providing to the fire service and the law enforcement professionals and some of the work that we're doing on staff at TRPA as part of the recovery. So that was an incredible fire briefing. I know the board will have lots of questions, but if we can just keep trucking along, we'll have a chance to get to all the questions after Kim and Kat wrap up. So take
yes,
it away,
Kim. Yes, please stay with us. Please stay with us. Yes.
Thank you so much, Julie. And thank you, Chief Anthony and Gwen. As Julie mentioned, I'm Kim Carringer. I am the Environmental Improvement Division Manager for TRPA. And we are going to close out this presentation, Kat and I, just on a couple slides on TRPA's role going forward in Caldor fire recovery, and then Kat will close up with our role working with the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team in the long term. So as you heard from our previous presenters, the fire suppression repair was enacted really quickly and it's already underway. Our partners at CAL FIRE and LTVMU have welcomed TRPA in right from the get-go. And there's been a lot of collaboration already underway to really map out our roles, our responsibilities right now in the immediate short term and in future planning for long-term fire recovery and climate resilience. And it was clear right from the beginning, as people have said here, that this fire recovery is going to span many years and it's going to cross a lot of different divisions at TRPA. So we quickly put together a cross-agency internal team to make sure we were really coordinated internally while we were engaging with our external partners. Next slide. Perfect, thanks. So I am leading this team with all the divisions here at TRPA, with current and long range planning, with the research and analysis division, my division, the environmental improvement division, and then of course communications. And so we have internal staff plugged both into the BEAR process right now and the state process known as the Watershed Ecosystem Recovery Team. Next slide. So we had staff go on tours with CAL FIRE just last week to really see firsthand the immediate repair work that's going on. And there's a picture from that tour last week where they're really working to stabilize and cover the bare soils for the immediate need right now to try to prevent any erosion control and debris flow in the immediate term. And we also have staff going out with the federal team today, I believe, to do the same. So as Chris and Gwen mentioned, there's been a lot of collaboration between the state and federal teams. And from what we've heard so far is these teams really are going above and beyond and really knowing the setting that they're in, as far as, even though we have people from all over the country coming in, knowing how important this region and watershed is for protecting the lake and protecting water quality, they're really going above and beyond for this area. So we also have people plugged in from our stormwater team. They're plugged in with our local jurisdictions, particularly El Dorado County and City of South Lake Tahoe, on what needs to be done in the immediate term with ash and debris flow and the potential for it entering their water quality infrastructure. We have so much. We're very, very benefited in Tahoe for all the water quality infrastructure we have in Tahoe. So protecting that and making sure we can keep it maintained to try to prevent flooding or reducing flows of these pollutants as much as possible. We have, like I said, our stormwater team plugged in with them already. We have a few different staff really working on that are already involved in sustainable recreation and our tourism initiatives in Tahoe. The Caldor fire will undoubtedly affect those. And so they'll be really engaged in this team to think about how we restore any trails that were damaged or rec sites, and really think about making sure those types of projects are included in our long-term recovery. Also, Dan Segan's plugged into this team, who's been working with the Tahoe Size Advisory Council to determine what are our short-term and long-term priorities for monitoring and really seeing how smoke or ash in the fire has impacted the basin. And last but not least, of course, we have Kat McIntyre, who you're gonna hear from next, about our engagement with the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team in forest restoration going forward. And so it's all of the agencies around the basin, the 21 different agencies as part of the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team, are really getting their feet underneath them. Let me go to the next slide, please. I just wanted to highlight, we are fortunate in Tahoe to already have the Environmental Improvement Program framework already established. And it's through the EIP that we all have a lot of experience in the basin on collaborative planning, funding, and implementation of restoration projects basin-wide, where we all work together to leverage each other's roles, leverage each other's funding, and really together making a greater impact. And as we work through the same framework, we will work at TRPA to really think about our planning in climate resilience and how we really continue to adapt the basin on living with fire. As we all know, this is likely not the last time we are going to see fire in the basin. So really, how do we work together to think about into the future, adapting our programs to the things that we need to do for climate resilience planning? So you'll hear more about that and how we're pivoting things internally to be responsive to that at TRPA. So with that, I will hand it over to Kat to talk about engagement with the TFFT.
Thanks, Kim.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kat McIntyre. I am the Forest Health Program Manager with the TRPA. As Chief Anthony mentioned, a little bit of background on the Tahoe Fire and Fuel Team. They were created in 2008 after the Angora Fire to implement the Multi-Jurisdictional Fuel Reduction and Wildfire Prevention Plan. It's 21 partner groups across the basin working to focus on fuels reduction, protection of communities, and also safeguarding environmental resources. Next slide, please. A large component of the Tahoe Fire and Fuel Team is the Fire Pit, which does communications. And right now, this group is focusing on providing a coordinated and unified message regarding the Caldor Fire and future recovery efforts, and also communicating the importance of defensible space and home hardening in mitigating risk to homes and communities. Some fun facts about that came out of this, the Fire Pit. In 2019, the Tahoe Network of Fire Adapted Communities reported a multitude of successes, but specifically 6 educational workshops that were held, 22 different community events that were attended by the Fire Pit and by Tahoe Network of Fire Adapted Communities, and 2,512 individuals that reached out specifically at those, or that were reached at those outreach events. So they're having impacts all across the basin in communicating the importance of specifically defensible space and home hardening. Next slide, please. So a little bit about defensible space. As you know, this is treating the vegetation around a structure to increase the likelihood of the structure surviving, mitigating fire risk, and ensuring firefighter safety. The Tahoe Fire and Fuels Team works with private and public landowners across multiple jurisdictions, all the jurisdictions in the basin, to help establish defensible space. And so I'm going to unpack the graph that you're seeing on your right a little bit, because I know it's all a little small, but this is parcels that have been inspected for defensible space from 2008 to 2020. And all of those different colors represent different fire protection districts in the basin. And the key takeaway from this this graph, this figure, is really this idea that it is a coordinated, multi-jurisdictional, basin-wide effort to have consistent messaging and reporting around defensible space. I believe it was Julie who mentioned we've had over 45,000 inspections within the basin, so that's hitting almost every parcel and some more. And so this is really just showing that TFFT is coordinating across all jurisdictions. It's not a focus in one area. It's really how do we focus as a team on the entire basin to get defensible space work done. Next slide, please. So what is the Tahoe Fire and Fuels Team doing now? So we are working to create a Caldor Fire Task Force, and this task force is really looking to focus on long-term recovery. So we heard a lot about the BEAR, we heard the BEAR team, we've heard a lot about the Watershed Ecosystem Recovery Team, the state kind of complement to the BEAR team. And so eventually those teams will wrap up their work, and this is where we feel that TFFT can kind of pick up the ball and run on this idea of long-term recovery and project implementation. And so the task force will coordinate on things like communication, funding opportunities, data collection and management, and forest restoration and recovery on the long term. Now, next slide, please. I do want to highlight, as many of you know, that there is still planning and implementation occurring all across the basin. So this is just a variety. This is just a few of the projects that I picked to highlight. But for example, the West Shore WUI has 2,600 acres of 4,800 acres already completed. This is to reduce stand densities for resilience and fire risk on the West Shore and create defensible space. We have Lake Tahoe West and the utilities resilience corridors that many of you know about. The South Shore Hazardous Fuels Reduction Project is 12,000 acres of national forest areas from Emerald Bay to Burke Creek, looking in the defense and threat zones and how do we treat those. The Bond Plan, which is in the Nevada side, is an 85-acre fuel reduction or fuel break that's created on the East Shore. The Marlette Summit Project, which was a 100-acre fuel reduction within the Lake Tahoe Nevada State Park to modify fire behavior The list goes on and on. And what we're seeing, and again, the kind of key takeaway, is that implementation is occurring within the general forest and within the wildland-urban interface all across the basin currently. Next slide, please. So I do want to highlight the steep slopes work that TRPA staff has been doing, as Chief Anthony brought up. We had a committee Forest Health and Wildfire Committee presentation in July on the modeling regarding thinning on slopes 30 to 50%. So we brought in the partner scientists to present those initial results. We're currently conducting the environmental analysis that would be needed for a code change to support a code change for thinning on slopes 30 to 50%. And staff will be bringing analysis and draft code language to the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee and the Governing Board in coming months for comment, review, and discussion. Next slide, please. So lastly, I want to wrap up with some funding pieces and looking to the future. So for those that don't know, SNPLMA is the Southern Nevada Public Management Act. It was created in 1998. And essentially what this does is it sells public lands in the Las Vegas area, and then it frees up that pot of money for a variety of projects, including Lake Tahoe restoration projects. As you can see from this slide, we're on round 18, and since it was created in 1998, there have been many opportunities or many pots of funding that have come forward over the years. So for SNPLMA round 18, the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team coordinated across the entire basin with all the partner groups, all the 21 groups, to submit a comprehensive basin-wide package of projects for funding at approximately $40 million. And I just want to kind of unpack what you're seeing here. This is just a zoomed in shot of South Lake, because to show you, or the South Shore, but this really is occurring all over the basin. So this is just to give you a zoomed in example, but I want to highlight that if we looked somewhere else in the basin, it would look like this too. And what you're seeing here, all the different colors are essentially all the different projects and organizations that were coordinated and integrated for the SNPLMA Round 18 funding nomination. And so the key takeaway is that we're really looking at how do we treat a landscape holistically? How do we coordinate across jurisdictions? How do we bring all of our partners together to look at the landscape as a whole in terms of forest resilience and wildfire risk reduction? And I do want to note, we anticipate approval of SNPLMA Round 18 funding any day now from the secretary. It's at the secretary's desk for approval. Next slide, please. So there are additional funding opportunities that the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team will be coordinating and identifying and working through and prioritizing over the next few months into the years. And those are things like emergency suppression repair funds, SNPLMA Round 19. So SNPLMA Round 19 was just released or was at the request for nominations was released within the last 2 weeks. And so Tahoe Fire and Fuels team is actively working on identifying what a package of nominations will look like for SNPLMA Round 19. We know there is definitely going to be a focus for the Nevada side of the basin. Lake Tahoe Restoration Act funding, private funding sources, and then state funds that will come in. Tahoe Fire and Fuels team is going to be looking at all these and identifying how do we prioritize and pick and allocate appropriately. And then next slide. And I believe I'm at the end, so I'm going to hand it back to Julie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kat. And thanks to all of our presenters. Really fantastic information. A couple of points I wanted to make before we open it up, toss it back to you, Mr. Chair, for questions. There are so many people who contributed to our community and getting our community out safely. We've mentioned many: law enforcement, the fire service, the resource professionals. There's also utility infrastructure. If we had had this fire in other places in the basin, we very well could have run out of water. And luckily, we had the South Tahoe Public Utility District with ample infrastructure to fight this fire. The export pipeline that carries treated effluent up and over Luther Pass into the Carson Valley has fire hydrants, and that was a big source of concern years ago about making that water available in the event of firefighting. And to my understanding, firefighters were hooking up to those purple hydrants just over the river from my house, you know, on Grass Lake Road, and every available resource was used, even garden hoses in people's individual properties. So the infrastructure need is great, in addition to everything that we've already covered. And then, of course, our local governments were involved daily in the emergency operations support. The city, the county, and our local communities were cooking meals for firefighters. So it was a major episode, that one that we will never forget. And we're just, again, grateful for the folks that were able to join us today to just give you a flavor of what's been happening in the last month. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to you to have board questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Julie. Well, I'm lucky enough to be the first person to be able to say hello today and to thank Gwen and Brian and Chris for starters. Our thanks cannot be overstated to you. I can tell you that for weeks I was receiving emails and phone calls from people literally all over the country who are concerned and worried about, you know, this place, that this majestic place that we call home and that we love and that we get, are just so lucky to spend our time in. And you and your teams, you know, you put your health on the line, your lives on the line, you worked around the clock, you were powerfully strong when you needed to be. And I just cannot thank you enough. And I'm sure that everybody here feels the same way. A tremendous amount of thanks also goes out to Kat and to Kim and to all of the other folks and Bud and all of the people who work so hard on the fire and fuels issues and on the committees and all of the agencies that are working so hard to protect us. So, I just feel like this is a day that it's important that we tell you this, that we express our thanks to you, because you come in from time to time over the last 8 or 9 years since I've been on the board, and we truly appreciate when you come in and you give us updates and you tell us how hard you're working. And this last month or so has been where we really see the accumulation and the miracle that you have created. It's really a miracle that you have helped create. So with that, I'm going to open it up to the other board members. I'm looking at my chat, and I'm going to start with Shelley. I see that you've got a question.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I certainly want to echo your comments regarding the magnitude of the task that everyone was confronting and the heroic effort put forth by everyone concerned. I just have a quick question for Gwen. And I think it was kind of dating myself. I think it was during Bill Morgan's tenure as the head of the Tahoe Basin Unit that the Forest Service began the process of decommissioning roads in the basin. And in view of recent events, do you think that's wise, especially when roads are required for heavy equipment access, for firefighting, and hopefully eventually for forest improvement work?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So we did go through a large review as part of our first plan and developing what right look like and what that balance is. So I do think that it's a balance. There are areas where we absolutely need access into, and we need to ensure that we are maintaining that system to allow for that access. Given that, perhaps we don't need as many roads as we needed or as we originally had. Road systems are very difficult to maintain, and they're also very difficult to ensure that they are maintained to the level that we don't find sedimentation issues, erosion issues, some of the other concerns that come with road systems. And so I do think that it's a fine balance. We've been working really hard to look at the areas that we need that access into and maintaining that access and trying to find a balance between that and areas which are really causing some harm to the environment with regards to, you know, poor layout, erosion, sedimentation issues. And so those areas that we were able to leave open, we are now able to maintain to a level which is much more friendly to some of the other resources, ecologic resources that we are trying to balance. And so I agree with you. I think it's a balance. And that was one of the things that we've worked really hard and continue to look at as we develop and organize all of our our vegetation treatments. And something we'll continue to look at in the future iterations of our forest plans.
Okay, thank you, Gwen.
Thank you, Shelley. I'd like to turn to Sue. And Sue, this was a big part of your life in the last month, and we want to thank you for your leadership in El Dorado County. You had a comment.
Thank you, and I apologize first for my cat. He's got a little PTSD going since 17 days of evacuations have affected him. He won't leave my sight, so I apologize for seeing him on the screen so much. But yeah, personally, it was it's been tough, but professionally, it's been incredible. Basically, every single constituent that I have was evacuated within this last 3 weeks. And, you know, we lost a lot of homes. It was very difficult. Julie and I understand uniquely from being Christmas Valley residents for 40 years, how scary it got. And, you know, it was difficult, but we're moving on. And I'm very, very proud, very, very proud of our firefighters. Gwen, you know, it's been such a pleasure to listen to your work that you're doing and to be a part of listening in, you know, not only just the cooperators meetings, but also those public meetings have been a huge help and comfort to our community. So thank you so very, very much. And again, to all the firefighters, it was amazing. And moving forward, I think we as TRPA, what, you know, I know we need to focus on is that second phase is, you know, how do we get through it? We've got winter coming up, we've got rains and snow, and Gwen, as you pulled me aside and we're talking about, and we all have our concerns about, is how in the world do we get that recovery moving forward where we don't have floods and storm issues into our beautiful waters. It's a big issue. And I'm still hearing helicopters flying over me in Christmas Valley. We've still got an active fire, and yet we're trying to get into that phase two. So I appreciate all your work, and I just want to say you've done a great job. It's just a huge relief to the community and to my constituents to know that it's been a coordinated effort and a very good effort. You've done everything you can. So thank you.
Thanks for those comments.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you, Sue. Really appreciate those. Barbara, you'd like to make a comment?
I would. First of all, I don't even know how to say thank you to all the first responders, but thank you very, very much for everybody that was there, for those who took people in, Sue, for what you've done. I just don't even know where to start or what to say, to be quite honest. But I want to thank Joanne for keeping us abreast. She did a very good job in her emails to us, which I shared with my team, and just to keep us abreast of what was going on. I was a former resident of Lake Tahoe on North Shore for 24 years, so I felt somewhat your pain, but not being there, I didn't know all of it. Did talk to some friends that were up there, so was kept abreast of things that were going on. Again, thank you, thank you, thank you. I was very intrigued by the redwood trees that were saved, that you, the firefighters made every effort to wrap those with a fire retardant wrap. There was a gentleman that wrapped his house with the fire retardant paper, I guess it is. But oh my gosh, all the things that we've learned and all the things that we've done. But again, thank you for the presentations today. Everyone that the chair said, I'm kind of at a loss for words, even though I know I talked a lot. but thank you. Thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart for everything that you've done and that you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. Really, really appreciate those comments. And now I'd like to turn to somebody else who was impacted significantly, has also played a big leadership role, and that's John Friedrich.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To add my thanks to all the firefighters and first responders. And boy, it's certainly, I think everyone in the community is so, so grateful. I know I saw Dan Sagan and other TRPA staff out at the gatherings of Ski Run and Needles, and Gwen was there. And I think a week ago, there were 500 or 600 people just in real kind of a grassroots community upwelling and cheering on the folks that had come in from Idaho and Montana and Southern California. And it was quite amazing. And so it just on the spirit of gratefulness, and I just wanted to share with everyone here and the public listening in that this Saturday, the city and LTCC are hosting at the community college at noon a ceremony to honor the firefighters at noon to 12:45. There'll be some stories from some firefighters, et cetera. And then after that, there's this extended community gathering together with the Tahoe Brew Fest, which has been a fundraiser for the Boys and Girls Club of Lake Tahoe. So just invite everyone to stop by there and a chance to write messages and greet firefighters, et cetera, even though as we recognize the suffering that others have experienced and the ongoing work that Gwen and others referenced. And then I have a question to Chris Anthony. Hi, Chris. you know, and others, but you mentioned, you know, one thing that could happen policy-wise is the 30% slope allowance of mechanized equipment. And I just wonder, it just seems to me with the attention here and the renewed focus on, you know, the need for pace and scale and building resilience to this new climate change abnormal we're in and expecting future mega fires, you know, what other opportunities do you see in the basin with, you know, take advantage of the $1 billion that the California legislature just authorized for wildfire prevention and the other sources that were mentioned to, you know, what opportunities we have to really ramp up and where, you know, where would you see that those needs could be, you know, best addressed if we were really to get some major resource infusion in the wake of this to prevent the next fire that may come our way?
Great question. So there are a lot of streams of funding that certainly do come into the Lake Tahoe Basin. And when it comes to thinking about kind of above and beyond just the increase in that slope percentage, as you well know, we still really haven't solved the problem with biomass utilization throughout the state. I think that's a really key component. Because obviously, when we go in and do any kind of resilient treatments in these areas, we need to have a place for that biomass to go. That has been a major challenge. I think we need to be looking at the landscape differently than we have. And I think Tahoe has been a great leader in this as it relates to Lake Tahoe West. There's been a lot of focus on the West Shore and that landscape level project there. And really the idea behind Lake Tahoe West was then to kind of replicate that around the lake on the north and the east shore. Obviously, a lot of work's been done in the south shore, but more needs to be done. So I think we need to, you know, continue that effort of looking at the large landscape kind of resilient projects. And that really just has to do with the fact that I was really surprised when Gwen said 3,800 acres had been treated of what had come into the basin. And I think it was just a little bit over 10,000 acres total burned in the Lake Tahoe Basin. And you think about that in terms of percentage, the amount of treated land in relation to the untreated land, it's a fairly high percentage of treated land. And I think that was really led to that success. And then lastly, implementers can really only get so far based on, you know, whether it's regulatory or policy constraints that they're faced with. And I think the group, the team of the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team has done a really great job working within the constraints that they have been working within. And, you know, we need to think a lot bigger than we have in the past. And that's really just a function of the fact that I don't think we expected to see fires burn with what I had mentioned before in terms of the same intensity and severity and duration and size that we're seeing. So I think for starters, those are good places to start. As it relates to funding, a lot of that funding is really specific to the type of project that you want to get done. So not every source of fund will cover every source of project. And so certainly at within Cal Fire and also in the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team, there's been a huge focus on home hardening. And Lake Valley had actually done roof replacement in many areas where the fire had occurred and had a grant program for that. As we know, there's high costs to some of these things. And so finding grant money to offset some of those costs for the individual homeowner, I think, is really, really important. And then the last thing that I'll mention, and I haven't really quite figured out how we solve this problem yet in the Lake Tahoe Basin, but as the local, state, and federal agencies do their work to protect communities, one of the legacies that we still have within our built subdivisions really is a high density of trees. And it's not so much that I think homeowners aren't willing to do some tree removal, because under the TRPA regulations, they can remove anything under 14 inches diameter without a permit. I don't think that that's the problem. The problem is the cost associated with actually doing that kind of removal, working around homes that are very close together, power lines, having to bring cranes in to move, you know, trees that actually aren't very large. It's just they can't be removed without, you know, kind of that expertise and level of equipment. And I think that needs to be, you know, a focus as well, not only to increase that defensible space, but also looking at it from a forest health and resilience standpoint too, because at some point, many of these trees are really starting to compete with each other. If we continue with these prolonged drought periods, we're probably going to see an increase in bark beetles that are going to come into the basin like we saw in the 90s. And we're going to see mortality, you know, one way or the other if we don't have forests that are resilient to, you know, bark beetles, drought, disease, and wildfire. So I think those are things that can be focused on in the future. And like you said, there are a lot of funding sources to do that. I would really encourage, at least on the California side of the basin, for the agencies to continue to look at the Fire Prevention Fund grants and the Forest Health grants. That's going to be a fairly steady flow of money over the course of the next several years. And then the other thing that I'll mention, building capacity. So Lake Tahoe Community College has been working on trying to ramp up basically a forestry program at the college. And the reason that's important is because forestry has kind of languished, I would say, over the years. And we need to recruit more forestry professionals really throughout the nation who can be stewards of our forest lands. And so I'm excited to see, you know, Lake Tahoe Community College. And I have to give a lot of credit to Kim Carr, who's doing this under a grant, and also the college for supporting this program moving forward.
Thank you, Chris, for that.
I think I know Kim Carr.
And thanks, John, for your questions and your comments. Yeah. And I'm glad that we record these meetings, because now we have an amazing blueprint, Chris, for what the things that we need to focus on going forward. Obviously, there's a lot of work to do, a lot of thought. But Chris, thank you for distilling that down and giving us some really good thoughts going forward. I'd like to now turn it to our fearless chair of the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee, who also was one of many extraordinary architects on the Blue Ribbon Committee coming out of the Angora fire, Bud Hicks.
I don't know about fearless, maybe elderly, but I appreciate your comment. I would like to say I as a former member of the Bi-State Fire Committee that was formed after the Angora fire, it is really gratifying to see what today's professionals have been able to accomplish in these 13, 14 years since that fire. And it's gratifying to see that the report of that committee, that commission, was not buried and forgotten. It really was a rewarding experience to be on it. There were so many really fine people from California and Nevada. We had fire experts. We had the environmental experts. We had caring people. And, of course, back then, quite frankly, all of the agencies, and especially the TRPA, it seems, had an angry public. And the public was angry over some of the restrictions and limitations on that prevented them from protecting their own properties. But also, there was it was sort of in the early days of education. I shouldn't say that, but, the education, the fire safety had been around, but people really didn't relate to it because, it was the Tahoe Basin and we're all up here to have fun. And looking back now over those years, it's just really rewarding. And I really do want to thank and acknowledge Gwen, Chris, and Brian, and all of your compatriots, all of your people and your agencies since that time up to the present, and particularly the amazing job that you've all done with the Caldor Fire, the Dixie Fire, the Tamarack Fire, all of these other fires that are surrounding us. It truly is amazing. One thing I think another quick lesson I've learned from my Bi-State Fire Commission days is, the things that we do as commissioners, I mean, I'm not a fire expert. I never have been. But the things that we do as commissioners is to allow a forum where we can listen and where people can speak and tell us what's going on. And we listen to the professionals, we listen to the public, and we listen to each other. And from that, we learn. And there's so much that in our own little way we can do to try to help out. And so, what we do here at the TRPA and as governing board members, we all have our lives, our constituencies, everything going on. But in the long term, over the long term, anything we can do to help address these problems will have long-term benefits for so many people. Now, with all of that said, we obviously have some very serious recovery and restoration matters that have to be addressed. And I really do thank Kat and Kim for their work on that and for their work in explaining it to me and explaining it to us and telling us what needs to be done, what is being done, and working with all of the agencies, coordinating the efforts of all of the agencies in the basin. And I can't thank you enough for your professionalism and all you have done for us. I think we've covered a lot of things today, and there's, just a million detailed questions that we could ask. But, the important thing is, number one, the fire, as pointed out, the fire isn't out yet. And even when this fire is out, the next one's, God only knows how long away it could be. It could be one day away or 10 years. Who knows? But there's work to be done. And, one of the things that I'm concerned about is that, we all know that our fire people are now, due to the circumstances of what's going on, they're dedicated to putting these fires out and fighting them. And there are going to be many more fires. And of course, our fire people are the resources that we look to do a lot of this preventative work for the future. And, I know no one has a simple answer to the question of how this will affect the preventative work that needs to be done. I am concerned, we have this wonderful project in process now over on the Tahoe West Shore, 60,000 acres. And there's no doubt that the forest thinning work needs to be done there, the forest health work, so that we can prevent or at least help reduce the impact of fires that will hit that area someday. But, you know, I would say that we as commissioners, we need to focus on doing everything we can to help all of our friends and our cooperative agencies to help them keep these things on track, moving forward, and to try to get them done as fast as we can, because there's always more work to be done. So anyway, that's enough for me, but I'd like to thank Gwen, Chris, and Brian. You folks and your people, you have such amazing wide responsibilities, and when the time comes for performance, you have performed extraordinarily well. Thank you.
Thank you, Bud. I really appreciate those comments, and thanks again for all your work since for more than a decade on these issues, Bud. I'd like to turn now to Wes, who was also in the line of fire and also had to be a strong leader through this process. Wes?
Well, thank you for that. But my comments are two points that I would like to make. Number one, the cooperation was incredible. During the Tamarack fire, every morning at 10 o'clock, I had the pleasure of driving off of the hill and going down to the high school where Cal Fire had a meeting every morning at 10 o'clock to let us know what was happening, where it was happening, what we as a community needed to be aware of, keeping the county manager, our fire chiefs, and everybody involved that were not firefighters to keep us informed and to get our input on our opinions as to what we needed to see happen. And again, on this fire, even though I'd been evacuated and I wasn't going to drive up the hill through the roadblocks every morning to go to the casino to send on the 10 o'clock. But thank goodness they had Zoom meetings every morning at 10 o'clock to give us the same information and to get our input. So for that, I was very thankful, very appreciative for all of the people that spent their time letting us know where we were, what was happening, what was probably coming next. The other point I wanted to make was that in the even before the fires that we had here in the basin, both the ones at the fire at Heavenly, Gondola fire. Thank you. We had what was called the Fire Safe Council here in Douglas County, here on the East Shore. And this was federal money that was made available for treating our own properties to make them more fire safe, which included removing trees. And I know that I had several trees removed from my property at very little cost to me. And I would like to see something similar or something akin to the Fire Safe Council basin-wide to help individual homeowners thin the forest on their land. And I would like to see the Forest Service again come in and treat their properties. Here on the East Shore, some of them were treated years ago, but things have a tendency to grow back. I would like to see the Forest Service come in, and although they allow us under the good neighbor policy to clear the pine needles and things adjacent to our properties, there's a lot of thinning that needs to go on here on the east side. So thank you.
Thank you, Wes. Really appreciate it. I'd like to now go to Cindy, who's been faced with a number of fires in her jurisdiction and has responded amazingly well to emergencies that through wildfire emergencies that have plagued her constituents.
Thanks, Mark. And I'm, of course, want to echo all of my gratitude to our first responders. and our presenters today and the efforts that have come about. I was able to go out with our Placer County CAL FIRE fire chief as the fire entered over the summit and watch some of the efforts of the firefighters in tracking down those embers. It was truly amazing. And for any of us who haven't had that chance to see it firsthand and be enveloped in that smoke and feel the heat through the vehicle of being so close to burning trees, none of us can thank you enough. But I think a group we haven't thanked enough are our local residents, and this especially watching the evacuation from South Shore and the efforts of the public to go ahead and get out of the way was so tremendously helpful. And I know we hear this a lot at TRPA that people are afraid we can't evacuate and we won't be able to evacuate in a timely manner. And yet that really did go well. There were delays, but we were evacuating. No city anywhere in the world can evacuate all its people without those kinds of delays. And I just want to thank everyone for the proactive approach at getting those folks out and in a safe and organized manner. As traumatic as it was for people to have to leave their homes, what a great job everybody did in calling that. And then also thanking our public for tolerating prescribed burns and for our fuels treatment and our changes in our code, because, you know, without the public support, we could fight and fight and fight on some of these issues. And I think we've come a long way and our public really is accepting of much more. If you get a chance, do take a look at the Chronicle from 2 days ago. There's a great article on how the prescribed burn areas did really help with the Calgary fire, and really explaining that to the public. And that education goes a long way when people are asked to tolerate smoke in the off season after having had a lot of smoke in the regular season to help us. And then my question, maybe more to all the experts, we know catastrophic wildfire changes our forest, and our forests have come to the place they are because we, because of our practices that interfered with nature. When we go to revegetate, is there a way, and are we looking at ways to recreate a more mature forest and more thoughtful plans on how we revegetate so that maybe we can skip revegetating as densely and then ending up with the same situation again?
Thank you very much. Very good question. Is it who'd like to try to address that?
I can take a stab first, and then maybe Chief Anthony can help me with the areas that I'm likely to miss, if that works for you, Chief.
Great. Thank you very much.
Great question. You know, the recovery phase of any fire is very delicate, and you know, we work with science, but it's not an exact science. And that is what makes it so hard, is there is a little bit of a human element that goes into the recovery phase of a fire and post-fire processes. I do think that over the last 20 years of us responding to fire recovery, we've learned a lot. And our practices have changed a lot. Even since the Angora fire, our practices have really had to evolve. And they've evolved because of what you're mentioning right now. They've had to evolve because our climates have evolved and our systems have evolved. And so we continue to look at what is right and where that sweet spot lies. And so when we look at revegetation, when we look at reforestation, the practices that you're going to see us implement on the Calder fire are different than some of the practices that you saw us implement on the Angora fire and some of the past fires. You know, it's pretty simple. Science has evolved, science has gotten better, and our climate has changed. And we simply, you're right, we are, our climate is such that we're not able to sustain as many trees as we were able to 30 or 40 years ago. And it is, it's in an environment where it doesn't make a lot of sense to stock levels at higher areas or higher densities, because those trees are all competing for the same amount of water and the same nutrients. And so I do think that our scientists, our specialists are looking at what that is. And we've continued to evolve and adjusted within our agency. The other thing that to really consider is, you know, some of these areas are able to be restocked and to be reforested, and some of our areas are simply not, based on slope, based on the rock, based on the soil type. And so some of that area, specifically within the Lake Tahoe Basin, is going to limit those restocking levels. And we'll have to kind of see, once that report comes out, what that looks like. And those will be things that I'll definitely look at and consider, is what is that sweet spot and what is that right level? We've learned a lot over the last 20 years of, you know, recovery, post-fire recovery, and what that looks like. And I expect that those post-fire recovery conditions and expectations are also going to be evolving, specifically on the Caldor, just because of where we're at with climate. It has to evolve. We have no other option but to evolve. So, Chief Anthony, anything I left out or anything that you have to add from a state's perspective?
Yeah, that was an excellent response, Gwen. And I'll be really careful that I don't speak on behalf of the Forest Service, because obviously they need to do their assessment and determine what is going to be best in the burned watershed in South Lake Tahoe. But when it comes to like the issue of forest management and reforestation, where I always start is, there was a tremendous amount of carbon that was released as a result of this fire. And really, I mean, all the fires, it's really a remarkable amount of carbon that gets released out of the living vegetation when it burns. And we certainly have some standing dead trees out there, quite a few that are still storing carbon as well, that either will be removed and stored in a different way, such as biomass or lumber or some other product, or it's eventually going to decay and release back into the atmosphere. Ideally, what you wouldn't want to see, except for those areas that Gwen had mentioned where it is difficult to restock or reforest an area, is our forests more and more throughout the state of California, after they burn, are converting back to brush, which is really kind of the natural succession. But it really has to do with the fact that our forests are burning so intensely. There's really no seed source left for trees to grow back in that area again. There are both private nurseries, as well as the Forest Service has a large nursery down in Placerville, where they can begin that process of growing trees to replant. And I know that's a goal of both private and public entities to do that. One of the considerations that has to go into that now is that seed stock that came from that area the most appropriate seed stock to now plant back into that area? And really where I'm going with that is, because of the way that our climate is changing, our trees may not necessarily be adapted to that elevation band anymore. So there's a lot of research that's going on related to that, and looking across seed zones on how we can use a seed from one other zone in another zone that would be more appropriate for that area. But really, at the end of the day, I think the goal of all the agencies is to try to appropriately restock those areas, and maybe not using the same stocking standards that we've used in the past in terms of number of new trees that get planted, looking at, you know, lower density levels that are more manageable kind of moving into the future. So So there are a lot of considerations that go into that, making sure that you have the right trees, the right mix of trees. And then also you need to have the funding to manage that moving forward. So you don't just plant a tree and walk away. There's a number of steps that go into ensuring the success of that reforestation effort that needs to occur. Those would be my additions to what Gwen said. And it's not specific to the Tahoe Basin. This is a statewide level issue that we have to somehow get ahead. Otherwise, we're just going to see these large landscapes convert to something else that's going to be a lot less desirable and quite honestly a lot more flammable, and that's going to carry fire even quicker than what we saw. And I'll just add one last thing. So Chief Newman, when he was on the Dixie Fire, when the Caldor Fire started, he had mentioned to me that he had to switch some modeling with the Caldor Fire from essentially a mixed conifer tree type to a brush type to replicate the just how fast the fire, you know, moved out of Grizzly Flat. And I thought that was really interesting that, you know, that those, you know, we have to make these shifts in our fire behavior modeling to better understand, you know, what's happening with our vegetation and our landscape.
Thank you very much, Chris. Appreciate that. I will say, I just have a brief little point here, and that is Bill had the lead to take care of his granddaughter. So we're hoping that we keep all of the remaining California members on for purposes of maintaining a quorum, because Sue had to leave and Bill has had to leave, and so we need everybody else. I want to thank you, Chris, for that great explanation. I would suggest, just for the record, there is a person who's been living in our community for the last couple of years, a PhD from Oxford. Lauren Fletcher is his name. He's a extraordinary expert in terms of seeding ecosystems, and just might be a really great resource for purposes of science and tree growth post fire. At this point in time, I'd like to move to Haley Williamson. Haley's young family had to be evacuated, and she has led extraordinarily as the chair of the PUC, which has a lot to do, frankly, with wildfires and forest fire protection. And so, Haley, I know you have you've got a comment.
Thank you so much, Chair, and my deep and profound thank you to the fire community, all of you on the phone, all of our leaders in the community. What an extraordinary summer it's been, and just such a deep thank you for all the work that all of you have done. My comment is towards that Public Utilities Commission piece of this. It's a sort of a comment, question, suggestion. As I'm sure you all know, utilities, as we talk about fire, you can't really talk about one without the other. We know that the Dixie Fire was started by utility equipment. There's a pretty staggering percentage of some of California's biggest blazes started by utility equipment. So as public utility commissions in the West start planning for this, we look more and more to our utilities to work with the fire community to put these issues in front of utility commissions who aren't traditionally fire experts. In Nevada in 2019, we had a bill pass requiring us to do natural disaster protection planning. So the PUC passed our first natural disaster protection plan for the Nevada side and the whole state of Nevada in 2020. One thing that we looked at was those power line corridors. I know in the Caldor Fire, those power line corridors provided a pretty important fuel break along Pioneer Trail. And as we look at those at the PUC, and this actually TRPA permits a lot of the tree removal on these, just want to make sure that PUCs, California, Nevada in particular here, are getting that information from the fire community on how wide those corridors should be around power lines. You get the sort of double bonus of being a fuel break and also preventing fire starts. Another thing I just want to make sure is on everyone's radar is, as part of that in Nevada protection planning, we also talked to the telecoms and the communication centers to make sure that, for instance, cell on wheels are available. I know that we had some of those provided for the Caldor Fire by NV Energy and some of our telecom providers.
So there's a lot of infrastructure, utility, telecom planning that goes on through the PUC process. California PUC has similar plans from the regulated entities pending before them. So just want to make sure that we're plugged into the fire community, getting your best recommendations on those utility corridors as we talk about undergrounding some of those power lines that we're not potentially losing some of those corridors. If we're putting lines underground, I don't know that we're getting the fuel break. We're certainly getting the fire start reduction there. But just that we're planning those all together and knowing that, you know, power during the Caldor fire, I was getting some briefings from NV Energy, making sure that, for instance, Lake Tahoe Airport was up and running for water drops and that they had power throughout that incident was key as well. So I guess that's a comment question sort of all rolled into one, but to make sure that we at the PUCs are being as helpful as we can as well to the fire community in your planning efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Haley. I really appreciate it. Would anyone like to respond to that with respect to the inquiry on relation to fire relation to PUC and what PUC might be able to, how they might be able to play a role in your strategies going forward? Chris or Gwen or Brian?
I will go ahead and start then. And I can only speak for the California side, but we've been engaging Liberty Utilities for quite some time because they quite honestly, they inherited a lot of challenges when they came into the basin. And their veg management folks have been really great to work with when we identify issues or threats to lines. And then I probably will kick this one over to Gwen, but there has been a tremendous amount of work and some grants that have been submitted that haven't been funded to do resilient corridors throughout the Lake Tahoe Basin, recognizing that not only is there a potential threat of trees moving into the power lines during the wind events that we have, but also as Haley mentioned, using those as a point of defense as well. So we know that risk is real and it's there. I'm not really too sure where we're at with the resilient corridor concept, but I do know that was something that was actively being worked on and may have found a different funding source.
Yeah, thanks, Excellent. Chief. Thank you. We do have a couple of different utility companies in and around the Caldor fire and in and around the basin. And so alongside Liberty Utilities, we have NV Energy as well. And we have been working really closely with our utility companies to ensure that they've got the ability to treat within those corridors and to make sure that it's coordinated. But we're not working to hamstring them either, right? There's a fine line between making sure that those are coordinated efforts which fall within our forest plan and making sure that they're falling within our marking guidelines and expectations there. But doing it enough that we don't have any of, we reduce those risks from those corridor infrastructures. One thing that I do want to point out, I'm sure you all are tracking on the infrastructure bill and what that looks like. There's a specific line item in there that speaks to infrastructure. And when we talk about infrastructure resiliency, I think this is really, you know, this is the base of that. How do we allow or broaden people's perspectives to see things like, you know, power lines as infrastructure resiliency, or making sure that we are allowing them to move into the future and do it in a way that reduces risk to that infrastructure. You hear a lot of that conversation in and around the country, and I think that is absolutely key here in California and Nevada, the Lake Tahoe Basin. And so I know that is one area that I am absolutely looking at as a forest supervisor. And how do we
take those potential funding opportunities, specifically around infrastructure, language, and try to utilize that to better secure and defend those utility companies or corridors, as well as other areas. And so I think that that is one aspect that we've got some opportunity, further opportunity coming towards us moving into the future. You know, we maybe weren't where we needed to be 20 years ago. We've come a long way. We've still got a long way to go on this one. And we're working hard with our utility companies across both state and federal areas to try to give them those opportunities that they need to better secure that infrastructure.
Thank you, Gwen. Really appreciate it. Okay. I'm not seeing any other folks from the board with questions or comments. Julie Reagan does have some follow-up and some closing comments before we go to public comment. Julie?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie Reagan again. And I wanted to thank our speakers. Again, this is a very busy time. The fire is not out. I mean, just to take 2 hours of your time is very generous, and we are grateful. We're grateful for all the work that we've covered so far. I wanted to throw a statistic out to round out this conversation about the resources. And Chief Anthony spoke to many pipelines of funds coming down the pike, and that's something that we're really engaged on. We're working with our Tahoe partnership, our California Tahoe Alliance partners, to advocate for climate resilience funding, for forest health funding at the state and federal levels. If you look at just the last 10 years in the EIP, we have invested $133 million in forest health. The lion's share of that is federal funds. And so we've already invested so much more than most communities, and I think it's helping us be prepared in all the what you've heard conveyed today. It takes money to do these projects, and we have a lot more to do. So we're going to need to continue to advocate, and we're going to continue to have that unified voice for Tahoe, with the Tahoe and Fire and Fuels team being a leader in bringing us all together to collaborate. So we look forward to that. I also wanted to pick up on what I heard a few of the speakers mention related to corridors. We are really supportive of all the utility corridor work, and our staff have met with the utility folks, with the PUC folks, to advance that work. And there are funding proposals on the table, which we hope to hear soon, particularly when Secretary Holland signs the SNPLMA Round 18, that will allow more of that work to continue. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for some positive results that will support a lot of good projects throughout the basin. And Bruce Barr, our own forester, has been heavily engaged working with utilities. If you drive up and down Pioneer Square and you see the blue paint on the trees, that's what Bruce worked with to mark those trees for the utility corridor on the South Shore. I think he's been marking thousands of trees just in the last couple of months, and working with utility providers, out with SDPUD, marking trees around pump stations and other critical infrastructure, even just ahead of this fire, to do additional vegetation clearance to help safeguard our public health and safety equipment. So it takes a village, and I'm just really proud of that teamwork, and can't thank our law enforcement and fire service professionals enough for all that you've done for our community. So, Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks so much for all of our staff speakers and for our guest speakers. Thank you for taking the time. We are here. Please let us know what we can do to help you do the wonderful work that you do. Thanks. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Gwen. Okay. We are going to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on these agenda on this item, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And Catherine, would you let us know?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, then we'll deem public comment closed. And we will go to item number 7. Well, Julie, are we good with respect to continuing here? Or are we, given that it's 1:20, are we going to break for 20 minutes so that people can refresh, get a bite to eat, a little snack or something, and jump right back in?
Mr. Chair, I would think your colleagues would probably welcome a break if that's acceptable to everybody.
Is everybody okay with taking 20 minutes? Great. Let's do 20 minutes. We'll be back at 1.
All right.
It's 1:40. And can we see from the attendees whether we've still got that quorum, John? Or Maria?
We have a quorum.
Excellent. Okay, we'll proceed. We are picking up at agenda item 7A, and that is the appeal of executive director approval of Westermeyer single family addition and remodel, 1015 Skyland Drive, Douglas County, Nevada, assessor parcel number 131803-210-030, TRPA file ERSP 2021-0347, appeal number admin 2021-0022. And the information on this item can be found on page 13 of your packet. As a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. Before we begin this appeal, if any board member has had ex parte communications with any of the party in this appeal, please disclose that now, or if you believe you have a conflict to disclose. I am looking at my chat. I don't see any. If you do want to disclose anything, please just jump in verbally. Hearing none, we will first give the report from the legal committee. John, do you want to give the report from legal?
Sure. The legal committee heard testimony from both sides in this appeal, as well as from staff, and voted unanimously to deny the appeal. So we'll invert that vote when we get to the actual action by the governing board, because we have to make a positive motion. But the overwhelming or the unanimous decision of the committee was to deny the appeal and affirm the decision of the executive director to issue the permit.
Great. Thank you, John. So as far as process goes, first, John will have 5 to 10 minutes to present this matter. After John is finished, we'll go to Gary Midkiff for a 10-minute presentation. And when Gary is finished, Nick Exline will have 10 minutes to follow up with on Gary's comments. John, go ahead.
Okay, I think Mike Johnson might be the Mr. Herwig's representative. I think Gary had a conflict, but we'll see when we get there.
Very good.
Okay, as indicated, this is an appeal from an executive director's approval of a permit for a single family rebuild, and the issue here is height and how TRPA staff calculated height. You'll hear just as a way of another introduction, you'll hear application was outsourced to a third party reviewer, Wells Barnett, and we have on the line Lynn Barnett from that office, as well as Jesse from that office, and Teresa Vance and Wendy Jepson from TRPA staff to help answer any questions. Next slide, please. This is just an area map. The parcel is outlined in red. This is in Skyland in Douglas County. And that is the Westermeyer parcel, the parcel that received the rebuild permit. The parcel just to the north, and I don't know, Catherine, are you on and can you? Just to the north where the red dot is the Herwig parcel, and Mr. Herwig is the one who filed the appeal. And really, he's filing the appeal because the reconstruction, I believe he contends, will block some of his view of the lake out towards Skyland Court. Next slide, please. This is the view of the existing dwelling on the Westermeyer parcel, and to the left is the Herwig parcel. And so what we're going to be talking about is the height of essentially the rebuild portion of the house that you see is essentially the garages, and I think it may be a complete teardown. Anyway, if we could go to the next slide. So this is the site plan, and you'll see that the bold lines associated on this proposed site plan is the foundation lines. And there's, you see the foundation for the house, the main part of the house, is bold, and they're consistent, and it's kind of circumscribing the white area. The house actually is it's not cantilevered. It's built over with two porches over the driveway, and that light lined area is an extension of the house that when we go to an elevation, you can see is built on these posts. And if Catherine, can you use your magic cursor and circle these posts, which are these squares. We went to the next, sorry. Which are these squares that are the foundation from which a lowest point of natural grade will be determined. All right, next slide, please. So there's two key ingredients to a height determination. One is the where do you start measuring your height? And under TRPA rules, it's lowest point of natural grade where it intercepts the foundation or the foundational elements, external walls, et cetera. And because we have these posts here, it's the nearest point of lowest point of natural grade to a post. And can you circle that lowest point of natural grade right there? And this, if you have sharp eyes, you'll see that in that little clouded bubble is LPNG, lotus point natural grade at 103.7. You'll see the little X that's circled in green at 103.2. That's the nearest accurate spot elevation. And then since we're about a foot away from that elevation point upslope, the actual finished or the actual calculated height for lowest point of natural grade is 103.7. All right, so that's how lowest point of natural grade was determined. It's consistent with all of our determinations. Now, can you move the cursor to the 102.6 spot elevation? And turn it red there, so it's right underneath that spot. This is the spot that the appellant or Mr. Herwig contends, and his consultant contends, is the spot that should have been used. It's not used because it's not close to a foundational element. It's significantly further away from any one of the posts that we would have to determine if you want more information about why the point nearest above, we can provide that at questions. But essentially staff chose and the consultant chose the nearest point of lowest natural grade to the foundational element, which is this post in the upper part of the diagram. Next slide, please. The next point of dispute is the cross slope. The cross slope essentially is one of the axes on our height table that determines, together with the roof pitch, the actual amount of height you can go up. And essentially, it goes up 6 inches, in my approximation, about 6 inches every 2 degrees of height. So what we're now talking about is the difference in 6 inches between what the appellant contends and what the agency found. The yellow line going through is an illustration of the cross slope calculated through the building site. And you'll see that it's perpendicular to the elevation lines, in particular the 108 line that was etched across the building slope. This is calculated just how we do all our height calculations. There's nothing out of the ordinary here, and this is described in the staff report. And the cross slope here, just a few feet to the right of the cross slope outside the building site, which was done during the site assessment portion, turns out unsurprisingly to be the same, 10%. So when you add those two calculations, the 10% cross slope plus the lowest point of natural grade, you come up with the allowable height that was determined by the consultant, checked over by TRPA, and is the guiding force of the permit that was issued for the allowable height. That's the end of our presentation. I suggest we take questions after you hear all the presentations from both the appellant and the permittee.
Great, thank you. And so, do we have clarification on who is representing the appellant here? Is Gary available, or did Gary have a conflict?
This is Gary Minkiv. I'm available, but I'd like to have Mike Johnson speak briefly before I go in.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
May I proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Okay. This is Mike Johnson, attorney for the appellant, Jonathan Herwig. I hadn't planned on being involved in today's presentation, and I'll be brief, and then I'll turn it over to Gary. The reason why I am involved, though, is my understanding of what happened this morning in the legal committee. As I understand it, there is a document in TRPA's file that until this morning we were unaware of, we being the Gary and the appellant and myself. This document in the file may have a material effect on the reasons why this application was granted at the staff level and maybe even played a role in the legal committee's decision today. And I don't think it was intentional. I suspect it was not. But the point is, there was a document, as I understand it, a document that had some topographic lines on it that makes it relevant to what we're discussing now, that was not available to us, was not available on the TRPA website for whatever reason. So we have concerns that, we're playing with a different deck than was being reviewed by staff and this morning by the legal committee. And we'd like the opportunity to consider the missing card from the deck that we didn't get a chance to look at. And I think it offends fundamental notions of due process, both substantive and procedural due process, that there's something happening at TRPA in the processing of this application, which includes a document that, for whatever reason, we are unaware of until this morning. I think it's important to know what it is being reviewed so we can, evaluate that ourselves. So what the appellant is asking is, first of all, Gary will speak to the merits of this and explain why the plans themselves exceed the allowable maximum allowable height under the TRPA code. But I would ask, if you're not inclined to do that right now, at a minimum, this matter should be sent back to staff. The approval should be vacated, and staff and we can all evaluate this based on the same deck of cards second time around. And with that, I would cede my remaining time to Gary Midkiff.
Gary, just one second. John, let me ask you this question, because as I understood it from this morning, the document that is being discussed was essentially just an exhibit without of which the calculations would have been exactly the same without it being shown kind of in a depictive way. John, can you address that?
Yes, and that's accurate, Mark. It essentially, for now just say that the illustration that they're talking about was purely illustrative. It was not operative in terms of the actual determination of the height of the building. We'll walk through that after Gary gives his presentation and after the permittee does as well. And I was going to do that on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you. There are several things I'd like to point out to the board for consideration. I'd like to have, if possible, John's site plan and my site plan side by side on the view.
I don't believe we can do that, Gary. We can just roll with your presentation as you asked us to put it together and put it up. So do you have that?
Okay, put my site plan on. Yes, thank you. I'm going to move it a little up. If you were looking carefully at John's presentation with his site plan, he shows the slope being calculated through the building site. Although when I talked to the outsourced reviewer, I was told in the documentation I got from a file said that they had used there's a line to the south of the house that was used by TRPA during the site assessment to classify the land capability and not the drawing through the building site. And also John's drawing of the slope through the building site does not go all the way through the building site. It goes from through the existing footprint that's bolded on the line, but not through the elevation and footprint of the living room and deck that projects out over the driveway. When you use the entire length of the building site, the cross slope is 8%, not 10%. And when you apply that with the roof pitch, that gives you a height of 25.7, not 36.1. And that's a case whether we're talking about a different low point or not. The issue with the column out to the north of the end of what you see on the plans for the footprint of that projecting living room is not visible on the copy of the site plan on the screen right now. If you look very carefully, you can see a part of it on the right side where the columns are, but there is no projection of that deck across the driveway to where I ended my crosset slope calculation. It was not apparent to me that there was a deck out there with a column further out. And when I talked to the outsourced consultant, that was not apparent, and I was not aware of that. Those things are elements that I did not consider and would have if I had been aware of them. So the crossover, I contend, is still in error, and the house very well might be overhyped, but because I was not aware of those additional information pieces that came to light this morning, I couldn't consider them in my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. Nick?
Good afternoon, Governing Board members. Nick Exline on behalf of the permittee. It's a pleasure being with everyone this afternoon virtually. And then for all of those back in Southlake, doubly excited to be with you. So, you know, my presentation is going to be brief and slightly different in that we're in complete agreement both with the permit, the process that was undertaken to have the permit be issued, the permit itself, the staff report of the legal committee, the determination of the legal committee, and John's presentation today. And so I won't reiterate any of those points in fairness and out of respect of everyone's time on this call. However, there's a few things I just want to point out just to kind of further fill in how these processes generally work and some of these nuanced decisions are made. So, you know, representing an applicant, you typically submit an application, you run your own cross slope, you start to develop your the design of the building, and you submit to TRPA. In this particular instance, the project was farmed out to third-party review, Wells Barnett & Associates. Many of you are familiar with Lynn Barnett, who handled the project's review for that. Lynn has a long reputation and was, you know, former manager of current planning at TRPA. So, following project submittal, there was a question regarding slope and height. And so what we did is what we always do. We collaborated as a team. So the designer, Wells Barnett, and TRPA staff met and said, okay, let's make sure we get this accurate because we want to be in accord with TRPA code and policies. And so as a result of that, they engaged with the surveyors to give us the spot elevation that it was referenced that derived the height. And that is accurate with every kind of historical TRPA interpretation of how height's calculated. And so really, we're supportive of both TRPA, the process that got us here, but more broadly, the interactive nature in which we were able to collaborate both with Wells Barnett and with TRPA to assure that we were bringing forward a complete project that'd be approvable, and it was. It's unfortunate we're here today. And so with that, I'm available for any questions, but fundamentally, again, completely in support of the staff report and John Marshall's comments. I would be remiss if I didn't, I suppose, address the comment pertaining to the additional information that came to light. As I'm sure John will touch on that, it appears to me that was simply a site plan in which Lynn Barnett decided to mark up with a highlighter one particular topo line. I've been challenged on projects for many, many things, almost every conceivable thing, but a highlighted a topo line on a map is a new one for me, so I guess I appreciate the newness of today. And so with that, I will turn that over to the Governing Board for questions, and of course, I'm available if you have any. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Nick. John, are we going to Lynn now?
Only if the Governing Board has questions. I was going to. You can give your questions now, or I can give a little rebuttal on this notion
please,
of new information. Okay.
Thank you.
Catherine, can you jump up to the first site plan in my presentation? Okay, so this is the site plan that everyone agrees was available. And unfortunately, it's because we were trying to fit it all on the slide, you can't see it. But we'll move down to the next one in just a second. But you'll see that same pillar, that same post with that little circle around it, which and that, if you zoomed in close enough, would read LPNG, the lowest point of natural grade. And then you'll see the spot elevation right there. So all of that is the operative information that drove the site and lowest point of natural grade calculation, which is right there. That has always been available to the applicant. Now let's move one slide forward, please.
what the applicant is saying they were that was new is this dashed line running down the 103 contour. That's what Lynn Barnett put on his working copy of the plans, and that's what this is a close-up of. That line is just there for his illustrative purposes. It doesn't operate in any way to identify the lowest point of natural grade, which was done off of that post and that site point right there at 103.2. Okay, so whether or not they have this, it doesn't matter to the actual calculation of height. You know, I think what we've got here is a site plan that was drawn on by the outside consultant, but it's not an effective line to the actual determination. Can we go to the other question that Gary raised was the fact that that it was unclear to him that the foundation elements was not this very lightly drawn extension over the driveway, that it was in fact these posts. And he says he was unaware and it was not apparent to him. I adamantly disagree. Can we go down to the elevation slides in Gary's presentation? So this is the elevation slides, and you can tell that this was available to the neighbor, Mr. Herwig, and you can tell that that whole aspect of the house is built on those posts that were calculated. And you can see that his highlighting here illustrates right in the area where he thinks the low point of natural grade is. So he knew or should have known that the low point of natural grade was not the wall, but actually where the pillar is. And that was the 103.7. So, you know, on both these points that they've raised, they don't hold water in terms of the actual operation and justification for the permit. I would like to just lastly add that we've litigated this due process issue in the Garmong case, and the district court dismissed a due process case that was based on a neighbor's interest in the permittee's application that was received. And lastly, think about what they're saying here. They're saying we didn't have the information that established that this was the correct way to do the height. So even if there was some, you know, if they didn't have that line, which again was not operative, they're still basically conceding that we did the calculation appropriately. And can we go up to my cross slope example, please? So what you'll notice about this cross slope from Gary's cross slope is that Gary's cross slope was essentially canted to the right. And what this represents is, and then he came up with a lower cross slope, which gets you a lower amount of height. And he did that based on what he says is extending the line all the way to the end of the extension over the driveway. But mainly it was at the 10% at the 8% because it was canted to the right. And that is quite honestly, that's maybe how he would have done it. But what staff did was draw right through the main section of the house and made it perpendicular to the lines of that are running through the house rather than in Gary's view, canting them off to the right and which we don't think is perpendicular to particularly the 104 and the 108 and then the 106 lines. But that, I think, is an illustration of the planner judgment that goes into these height derivations. So I think we're ready for governing board questions.
Great. Anybody have questions? I'm looking at the chat. At this point in time, I don't see any questions. Maybe it'd be easier if you just raise your hand if you do have a question. Shelley has a question. Go ahead, Shelley.
John, I know this is really focused on an interpretation of our code with respect to establishing, the low point. I'm just curious. This application didn't require the preparation of a simulation to determine what it would look like from various vantage points, including from the neighbor's property. Correct.
Correct. This house is not visible from the lake, and we don't require simulations based on impact to private views, or in this case, that would be Mr. Herwig's property.
Okay, and presumably the setbacks are all in keeping with our code?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see anything in the chat yet, and I don't see anybody raising their hand. So, John, at this point in time, do we want to go to public comment?
Yes, please.
Okay, we'll now go to public interest comment on this item. Any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on these agenda items, please raise your hand now and go to webinar to be unmuted to TRPA staff by TRPA staff. Catherine, if you could help us with public comment, that'd be great.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan Herwig, if you unmute yourself, you can address the governing board.
I appreciate the opportunity to address the governing board. I am the appellant in this case, and I did want to discuss one of the things that was just said, and that was that this house is not visible from the lake. It is clearly visible from there. The photo that was given, that was put on the website, was taken in such a way that it was blocked by the pump house that we have here in Skyland. But if you move either direction, you can easily see the house from there as it currently exists. And the house that will be built will dominate the entire beach area there. So I did want to make that very clear. I guess I'm an environmental consultant, and I've been through a lot of permitting hearings and things. And I've never experienced something like this where the reviewer of a permit is also, in essence, I'm trying to make up for the deficiencies of the permit design. It seems very odd to me. I think that is what Wells Barnett is trying to do here. There are various reasons why that might be happening. We had heard that that from Jesse Walker of Wells Barnett that they had looked at the permit, they identified deficiencies, they sent it back to the Westermeyer architect to take care of the deficiencies. When she returned those revised drawings, they were not addressed, but Mr. Walker indicated that the TRPA staff ignored that and instead issued the permit rather than sending the information back to Wells Barnett so they could identify the deficiencies. So it seems to me that there's a strange permitting process. I think there's problems with it. I guess also, when Mr. Marshall a couple of days ago called up Mr. Midkiff and suggested that we drop our appeal because the board, what he said essentially, was incapable of understanding these issues and would just disapprove it. It also strikes me as there's a problem with the permitting process here. And what I'm asking the board to do is to recognize this and to approve the appeal, or at least approve a continuance, so we can take a look at this and make sure that this design is copacetic with your regulations. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you, Catherine. Is there any other public comment?
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you. At this point in time, I'd like to bring it back to the board for any other questions or comments. I see from Shelley asking whether or not we can hear from Lynn about the petition here, about the appeal. John, is Lynn available?
I believe he's on the line. And Lynn, I think the comment is, can we hear from Lynn about the alleged deficiencies?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I can, yes. Lynn. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Lynn Barnett. Just to give you a quick background of my work with TRPA, I was with the agency for 25 years, starting 1986. Always worked in the environmental review or project review division, reviewing projects. My last 12 years with the agency, I was the department chief in charge of all that work. In 2011, I left the agency. Jerry Wells, your former deputy director, he and I started a consulting business. And that's where I'm calling from now, Wells Barnett Associates. I can tell you that in my experience with plan review, I personally reviewed hundreds, possibly thousands of projects such as this, either directly or through my staff. So, you know, I have to kind of take umbrage at this accusation that, you know, there's something going on, some collusion or some other factor. I think if you can't win on the facts and you have to pick on the consultant, this was a pretty vanilla project, to be honest with you. Set the record straight, the house is visible from the lake, but, you know, not very well visible. It's not a lakefront. It's not in the shore zone, shoreland. We reviewed the house initially, and we did have communications with the architect and asked for additional information, make some corrections. That's very normal in a review process. I think you heard that from Nick Exline, who works on that side of the fence. And we finally got a set of plans that passed the test. We issued a permit for this. We made findings for the height. And what you see on the orange line, the infamous orange line now, is this is a work in progress. It was our own internal deliberations. When we review plans, and I think your own staff will say the same, it's very common to mark up your plans as you're going through and reviewing things. It's common to write notes, verify points. What we have on this survey, fortunately, is besides topographic contours at 2-foot intervals, which is the requirement in your application packet, we have a number of spot elevations. So when a surveyor goes to a project or property such as this, they'll make spot elevations all throughout the property, make field notes, and they'll draw the site plan. They estimate where those 2-foot contours are based on their spot elevations. When we were reviewing these plans, I was curious on where that middle elevation is. That's in my drawing, that's a 1-foot contour elevation. That's just my own estimation. I wanted to kind of see for myself where that fell. It did not change the height calculation one iota. It had nothing to do with that. And for me to hear that the architect got some special favor out of this or treatment is offensive to me. I will just tell you that these plans are not complicated when it comes any more than a normal project. We did not look at the view protection from the neighbor, as John Marshall mentioned a minute ago. That's not part of the calculus that we look at. If this was a lakefront property, we would be doing shoreland calculations. We'd be measuring visible mass. That's not the case in this situation. It's not a protected property. And I stand by our decision. And I think the TRPA staff, who we were in communication with all through the process, and at the end when we issued the permit, we had a discussion with them. We always present our draft permits and have discussions with staff, and it's not common, but sometimes the staff will ask us to make revisions. In this case, the permit passed muster and it was issued. So I'll just say that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
you. Appreciate it, Lynn. Does anyone have any questions or comments based on anything they've heard, including Lynn's explanation? I don't see anything in the chat. I don't see any visual hand raising. At this point in time, I will entertain a motion. John, do you want to explain how the motion works?
Yeah, this is actually this is the motion from this morning. I'm sorry, this is the right motion. We need a motion to grant the appeal to affirm the decision of the executive director. You are to vote no on this motion. To grant the appeal, you would vote yes. The recommendation of the unanimous recommendation of the legal committee was to deny the appeal. So that would be a no vote on this motion.
Thank you. Catherine, would you please take the roll?
I move to grant the appeal.
Yeah. Thank you, Shelley. And Maria, may we please take the roll?
Ms. Alding?
No.
Ms. Faustinos?
No.
Mrs. Sagaski? Mr. Friedrich?
No.
Ms. Hill?
No.
Ms. Gustafson?
No.
Mr. Lawrence?
No.
Ms. Novosel? Mr. Rice?
No.
Mr. Yates?
No.
Ms. Williamson?
No.
Mr. Bruce? Mr. Bruce?
Sorry, no.
Hey, Mr. Chair, that motion fails.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both the appellant and the permittee, and for all of the witnesses for attending, for helping us understand what the issue was. And thank you to Lynn and to John for also adding the arguments. So at this point in time, we'd like to move to item number 8. And this is reports. I'll pass this off to Julie Reagan with respect to the executive director report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Julie Reagan here. I know we've had a very big day. Appreciate your attention and all that engagement on the Caldor Fire debriefing. I think more to come, and I know the fire is even acting up as we speak. So keep sending positive thoughts for our fire team to get that fire out. So appreciate that. Also, in other business, I wanted to give a report that last night, several members of our team, myself, John Marshall, Paul Nielsen, Tiffany Good, participated in the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association town hall meeting. You know, we're very engaged with the Keys on a number of fronts. Certainly, you've heard other briefings on the invasive species weeds control project out there, but last night, the topic was our pending MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, on the shoreline implementation for moorings. and getting the keys into a mooring registration program that was contained in the approved shoreline plan of 2018. And I just want to thank the staff that have been working quite literally for the last 4 years to do this. It is a very complicated matter, but last night we heard a lot of support from the homeowners. It was held at the pavilion in the Tahoe Keys, some in person, and as well as some virtual, a lot of virtual participation. And the board will be voting on that soon. So hopefully, I told Joanne if we could deliver that during her absence, that would make it all worthwhile, and she would be very happy coming back into the chair of executive director in another 6 weeks. So fingers crossed that we will bring that project over the finish line, but certainly appreciate Paul Nielsen and John Marshall and Tiffany, who have been working tirelessly along with other staff to make this happen. So that's one item. And then the other item related to the keys is that we hit a milestone in the weeds control project that's been going on for some time. The environmental analysis has been done, and Lahontan, the water board, released a draft discharge permit as part of their regulatory process. Despite the fire, we were afraid that might slip with the schedule, but they made it happen. And by working together, we are still on track to have a decision at the Lahontan Water Board in January. And then it will come back to you for a decision in the January board meeting, so late January. And of course, we know this is a very high priority lake clarity issue with invasive species moving from out of the Keys into other parts of the lake. So stay tuned for more on that. And then I'll just leave it there. There are many other big issues going on, but we're keeping things moving forward. And really also wanted you to know just to that I'll send your best wishes to Joanne as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you very much. And that's really, really great news with respect to Lahontan getting that draft discharge permit out. John Marshall.
I think you've heard enough from me today, so no report.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much, John. We're moving on to item 9, governing board members' reports. I will ask if anybody has a report. If you want to raise your hand, I'll recognize you, or if you want to send me a chat. I don't see any hands raised, and I don't see anything in the chat. So we'll now move to item 10, committee reports.
Wes was raising his hand.
Oh, Wes, sorry. Go ahead, Wes. Apologize.
The invisible hand. I just want to say that, as you know, in Douglas County, we've been having quite a to-do over the we call them VHRs in South Lake. They're STRs. We finally came up with our final panel, who will be our advisory board. Two lake residents that have permits, two lake residents do not have permits, and one from the East Fork area. So we have a five-member panel, or a five-member board. The names are Loren Romaine, Michael Sloan, who are both VHR permit holders, a Brian Keith Beyer, and a Mickey Hempler, who are not permit holders, who live at Lake Tahoe. And then from the valley, we picked Patty Graff. So that is now in place, and they will be hearing any appeals for fines instead of the board. Thank you for that, and that end of report.
Thank you so much, Wes. I don't see any more on the chat, and I'm looking for invisible hands. I don't see any invisible hands. So at this point in time, I'd like to go to committee reports. And we will start with local government, who is gone. Did the vice chair for local government have anything? I don't see anybody on that. Legal committee, we've had plenty of legal today. Operations and governance, Shelley?
Well, as you know, the operations and governance committee did not meet today, and I have nothing to report.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Shelley. Jim, you had a really busy day today, and you led a really fantastic meeting, I felt. And I wanted to know if you had anything else for us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I know it's been a long day. The committee met. We had a really good discussion. The purpose of the meeting this morning was the consultant that was hired to come up with revenue suggestions for transportation gave their findings after a series of interviews with key stakeholders. Their presentation were along the lines of what they felt was feasible revenue sources and perhaps those that were not as feasible in order to get to that $20 million per year target. It was a very robust discussion, and a lot of questions were asked. And so I'm confident that if we can get those questions answered, we could have even a more productive discussion at next time we meet. So thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. And I wanted to thank everybody for their very active participation and involvement in that meeting. It was a really good meeting. Let's see. ARPIC, Bill. And Bud, I'm going to
I think see. On the next month, I think we're going to have the mobility impact fee coming up. And that's all that I know. So,
okay. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Bill, for staying with us today and maintaining that quorum. I know you had something that was really important, and I want to thank you for your commitment. But I saved you for last because we had the biggest, most interesting fire and fuels discussion that we've had for a long time.
Well, thank you. But, you know, our thanks are due to Joanne and staff, particularly Kim Carringer and Kat McIntyre. They did all the work on that, and it was a wonderful job. We appreciate it. As I believe Kat McIntyre mentioned during her presentation, we will be addressing the question of use of mechanical equipment on steeper slopes than 30 degrees. So that'll be coming up before you in the coming months. As my fellow Commissioner John mentioned, biomass, I think we're going to be taking more time on that too. It's obviously a real important question now. And other issues, like I said before, you know, there's amazing amount of work was done on this Caldor fire, but there's amazing amount of work that has to be done to prevent future fires or to prepare the basin for future fires. Thank you.
Thank you, Bud. And I just, you know, that whole discussion involving the Calder fire and the other fires that are close to or in the Calder counties was extraordinary in many respects. But one was just looking at the members of this governing board and looking at the leadership in so many different ways and the people who were strong and did what they needed to do when it mattered the most. And so I was really proud to be able to kind of intro and call on all of you with respect to that discussion, because I think everybody did a really wonderful job, and we'll just keep at it because there's a lot of work to do. At this point in time, we're going to move to item 11. And that is the final public comment. I'm going to read the rules real quick. Our final matter of business is our general public interest comment period. Any member of the public wish to address the governing board on any item listed or not listed on the agenda, including items on the consent calendar, may do so at this time. Individuals or groups who have already commented on items listed on the agenda are not permitted to comment on the same topic. The governing board is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public during this public comment period. We'll hear comments on any single topic not on the agenda for up to but not to exceed 30 minutes. We'll hear as many unique comments as possible, and we will hear comments for up to but not more than a total of 60 minutes. All unheard comments can be submitted via email to mambler@trpa.gov and will be forwarded to all governing board members. If any member of the public wishes to speak at this time, please raise your hand and go to webinar. You will be unmuted one at a time by TRPA staff who will indicate that you have the floor. At this point in time, I'll turn it over to Catherine to take the public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Great. Thank you so much. So we will deem public comment closed at this time. And if somebody would please make a motion to adjourn, we can adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you all so much. See you soon.